Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program was brought to you by the Nutritional Therapy Association, real education for people who believe in real food. For more information, visit nutritionaltherapy.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. In the world of food policy, and indeed on our show, conversations typically focus on what's best for our bodies, or how to make sure everyone is fed. From school food to obesity policy to SNAP dollars, nutrition is often the dominant standard by which we measure whether or not our food is good. But food has impacts beyond just our bodies and our personal health, and policy has a role to play in changing the way our food system affects the environment and the climate. Joining us today to discuss the importance of addressing sustainability issues in our food system is Bob Martin, the director of the Food System Policy Program at Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. Previously, Bob worked for the Pew Charitable Trusts, where he served as a senior officer at the Environment Group, following the dissemination of his work as executive director of the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. Throughout his experiences, he's acquired an extensive knowledge of agriculture, environmental, and health policy, and I'm thrilled to be speaking with him today. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate being on.
Well, we appreciate you being here. I want to jump right in here and discuss the results of a survey that you recently published, which found that 74% of adults believe the newly released dietary guidelines should include environmental provisions and support sustainable agriculture practices. Can you tell us a little bit about the scope of the survey and what inspired you to commission it?
Sure. It was a survey of 800 people of voting age in the United States, and the Center for a Livable Future had been actively involved in commenting on the dietary guidelines process as they were being developed. Every 5 years, the government reviews nutrition and other science information to make dietary recommendations to the public. They're just recommendations, but they tend to set kind of a national tone for what people should be consuming. So this year, we were very strongly in favor of including sustainability provisions as part of the dietary guidelines, in that we think people should consider, as they're making dietary choices, kind of the source of their food and how it's raised, because sustainability is an important part of being able to feed ourselves. The guidelines came out, and those the lower meat recommendations, which we also strongly supported as an environmental and health issue, and the sustainability language were not included, so we thought we would see what the general public felt about it.
So words like sustainable and responsibly produced are used to usually kind of describe a vague way of food production that has more of a limited impact on the environment. But in my opinion, I think these words are not really well understood and sometimes misused. So can you, for the purposes of the study, explain how you define sustainable agricultural practices? Like, what does
certainly.
That mean?
Yeah, certainly. There's a definition that's commonly accepted in ag, federal ag policy. I think it was originally part of the 1996 Farm Bill. And it generally has components that are produce healthy food, do not destroy the environment, but actually enhance the environment, don't deplete natural resources. So we defined it for the purposes of this poll as we asked questions, you know, healthy, nutritious food that does not harm the environment in the production process. And so it was kind of our derivative of what is the commonly accepted language in ag policy at the federal level.
So what does that mean, though, to doesn't harm the environment in the production process? Is that not using pesticides or reduction in meat consumption? Was there anything that you were kind of trying to get at specifically?
Well, the center is focused primarily on industrial meat production, or the industrial model of meat production. And when you separate the animals out of the production cycle of crops and put them in intensive settings like, you know, 20,000 pigs in a swine barn or 100,000 chickens in a poultry barn, they're removed from the kind of replenishing cycle that that animals provide for crop nutrients, and their waste then becomes a disposal problem. For example, if you look at the Delmarva Peninsula on the eastern shore of Maryland, where about 525 million chickens are raised annually, when they're not part of the crop rotation environment where they're integrated into this crop production system, so they're depositing their waste naturally, it really builds up. They produce 43 million cubic feet of waste a year.
I can't even imagine what that looks like, but I don't think I want to know.
Well, to visualize it, it's enough to fill the U.S. Capitol dome every week.
Okay, wow. Well, that is a visual.
Yeah, it's well, and some people, I didn't mean to have any political commentary there.
No.
So in a more sustainable system, the animals are integrated into the production cycle. It's not necessarily free range, but there's a component of that in broiler production, or the hogs are not raised in an intensive barn confined where their waste becomes an environmental disposal problem. That's where it's kind of interesting. That's where it flips from their waste being a nutrient important to raising crops to being a disposal problem because of the volume.
Right. And this is, you wrote about this or, you know, did a lot of this work when you were at Pew, correct? When you produced the report, Putting Meat on the Table, Industrial Farm Animal Production in America.
Right. Yeah, I led that commission for 3 years. It was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust and was housed at the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins.
And so in a lot of ways, it seems like this survey is sort of an extension of, or are you trying to get at an extension of kind of the work that you initially did with the report?
Yeah, I think that what we wanted to see, so I came back to the Center for a Livable Future about 5 years ago, and we're trying to build a stronger policy program. And one of the things that I think is very helpful when you're trying to understand policy is you need to understand what public think about the policy. And so we wanted, it is kind of a progression from the Pew Commission report, where we found significant environmental and health concerns based on the industrial animal model, to us commenting on the dietary guidelines, and then this process where the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Commission made these strong recommendations, and Secretary Vilsack, USDA Secretary Vilsack, just totally ignored the sustainability and less meat guidelines. And so that's why we thought, well, let's see what the public thinks about this. And as you said, 74%, and it was really across all party lines, you know, wanted to include sustainability. 79% of respondents said that they wanted the scientists making the decisions on the recommendations and not politicians, which I think should be a wake-up call to the members of Congress who really voted to damage the process going forward. And then one of the more interesting things, I think, for me, too, was that 52% of the people responding said they'd be less likely to reelect a politician that ignored sustainability in the dietary guidelines. I've not seen anything like that before.
Right. Okay. So a lot to unpack here. So my first question, I think, kind of going to what you said about Americans wanting experts not politicians to set the dietary guidelines. You know, I read that and I thought, do they? Is that really what they want? Because I feel like, you know, for instance, in this last round, there was a lot of pushback against the experts from industry and politicians representing their constituents. And there were a lot of allegations that maybe there wasn't enough evidence, you know, to support some of these recommendations. And then furthermore, I think that there was a lot of pushback when the scientists for the first time kind of attempted to make policy suggestions that would directly employ or enable their recommendations. So I guess my question to you is, I mean, do you think that the survey was really representative given what we just saw?
Well, I think so, because you have to separate out one reason why you do polling is to find out in an anonymous, blinded way what people think about issues. So this is not necessarily a poll of the meat industry or of politicians, although we found that a significant number of families who said they made their living from farming, I think it was about 55%, wanted sustainability to be included and wanted the scientists to make the decisions. So I think there was a split, and I think Secretary Vilsack was really supporting kind of the interest of the industry over the interest of the general public. And this is not the first time. I mean, there was a lot of criticism that, you know, well, this really wasn't about nutrition, and so why were they talking about sustainability?
Right.
In previous years, the dietary guidelines have recommended not advertising sugar to children. They've recommended exercise as part of a diet regimen. So it's really, and frankly, there's a significant body of science that talks about the importance of sustainable production as a way to allow us to keep producing into the future.
So okay. Right. So there is. It just kind of, that was sort of some of the pushback that we saw, you're saying, from like a select group, basically, that was more vocal.
Right.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know a lot of the American Meat Institute pushed back, and there are species promotion groups like the National Pork Producers Council or the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, but they're pushing back because they make a lot of money from the current system, and if they would just, like, open their minds a little bit, they'd make a lot of money from a more sustainable system as well. But so I think it was challenging their business model.
Right. And I want to talk about kind of what that more sustainable system would look like in a minute. But some of the other kind of questions I had about the findings in terms of, you know, one of your findings, 9 out of 10 Americans want to make sure that the food is produced in a sustainable way. For instance, they ranked this as very high or somewhat high priority. Do you feel like people, like the general public right now, is reflecting this sentiment by putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak, by voting with their dollars?
Well, yeah, I think to a certain degree that's right, and I think it'll be interesting. We'd like to do more research in this area and other food production areas to see what different demographic groups feel about it. But I do think that you're seeing an increase in spending in more sustainable production, and I actually think that a couple of the more traditional companies like the Purdue Chicken Company, for example, recently just bought Nyman Pork. And Nyman Pork is rated one of the highest sustainable pork production systems, probably the highest in the country for pork production. And Hormel Meats, which is a more traditional industrial meat company, just bought Applegate Farm.
Think Spam.
They make Spam. Yeah. Who didn't have an unfortunate Spam sandwich growing up? But so I think they saw consumers are going in this direction and willing to pay more. And so Hormel bought Applegate, which is has a sterling reputation for its production system. They have the famous, I think you've probably heard, eat less but better meat.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think you see it, and it's still probably not strong enough yet to force significant market change, but we're moving in that direction.
Right. Well, and I think you're right that, you know, the recent acquisition of these smaller, sort of more darling, sustainable brands is a definite indication for the future. But one of the things that I know that these smaller brands kind of come up against is with the supply chain. You know, there's not enough. I've heard from representatives at some of these companies that, you know, it's a constant struggle to raise, to meet the demands for sustainably raised meat because it simply takes longer, or, you know, they don't want to do the shortcuts that you see in more industrial farming practices. Is this something that you have done any research on, or do you think that this is a big supply chain issue for the industry moving forward? And can we, I'm throwing three questions at you all at once. Like, can we support a more sustainable practice for meat at the rate that we're consuming?
Well, those are very good questions. I think that you're right. It is harder. It does take more time. It's a little more work intensive. There's also a bit of a problem in some areas of access to slaughter facilities, which is part of the supply chain question you're asking too, that sustainable producers and or organic producers for different animal species or grass-fed beef really have to pay a premium at slaughter facilities. They have to protect their brand. Mm-hmm. They have to pay for cleaning of the slaughter facility before and after the run of their animals through the system. And because they, like you said, they don't produce in as large in numbers as the industrial system, that's all those things drive up the cost. But I do think that as you reintegrate animals into the crop rotation production part of it, I mean, part of the problem with the industrial system is you separate the animals out, like I said, and they're fed antibiotics because they're overcrowded and their waste becomes a disposal problem. When you reintegrate them back into the crop rotation system, moving them around to help fertilize the fields, you eliminate those externalized costs of antibiotic resistance costs and environmental damage.
To offset the difference,
right.
Okay, great. All right, well, we're going to actually take a quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, and we're going to be right back.
Thank you very much.
Today's program was brought to you by the Nutritional Therapy Association. The Nutritional Therapy Association, NTA, is a vocational nutrition school that develops, trains, and certifies nutritional therapy practitioners and nutritional therapy consultants to understand and reverse the tragic and unsuspected effects of the modern diet on their clients based on their bio-individual nutritional needs. There's no perfect diet for everyone. Their philosophy is that the myriad of health problems that plague modern society result from weakness in the body's physiological foundations as a result of poor nutrition, and that everyone deserves to be healthy. Throughout NTA seminars, students access a wide range of educational tools and techniques that help identify and correct nutritional imbalances from a holistic perspective, emphasizing the importance of properly prepared, nutrient-dense whole foods. Their organization was founded on the teachings of Weston A. Price and the science of Dr. Francis M. Pottinger. For more information, visit nutritionaltherapy.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Bob Martin from the Center for a Livable Future. Okay, so we were talking before the break about the survey that your program recently your organization recently commissioned and its findings. And I'm wondering from your perspective if there is something that you saw in the results, given all of your experience in the public health field and agriculture field, that you found to be incredibly surprising, that you were just really not expecting.
Well, that's a very good question. I think the 74% figure about including sustainability was kind of what I anticipated, because other polls over the last year had shown similar results. I think a couple of things that really surprised me was the 92% figure that people want food produced sustainably, and the fact that it was very high across, you know, Democrat, Independent, and Republican breakouts. There was not a significant difference in that regard. And so that was a bit of a surprise to me, that it is not really a partisan issue, that it's really, it's something that people of all political persuasions want.
Do you think it's being billed as a partisan issue, though, or misconstrued as a partisan issue?
Well, I don't know. I mean, not so much. The stunning thing for me is how much food issues are ignored just generally politically.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
you don't hear any of the presidential candidates talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's, although I think there is some kind of feeling that maybe, you know, sustainability issues tend to be more of a Democratic position and not
issues,
so much concern of Republicans.
Right. Okay, so let's say in like a more perfect world that environmental impact was something that was included in the dietary guidelines. What would that look like in practice? Like, would there be labels or, you know, a nutrition facts panel or some other kind of, assessment that would be required? What do you think? How would that play out?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, I think that the main benefit, if that language had been included in the dietary guidelines, would be how it would influence purchasing of individuals and how it might encourage companies to move to more sustainable production. It also kind of informs the government purchasing process that. And I would have to say President Obama's done a pretty good job of trying to move government contract purchasing more in the direction of more sustainable livestock and vegetable production. So I don't know. I mean, it'd be great if there were some type of rating and assessment that could easily inform people about who are concerned about sustainability that, yes, this is sustainable and, you know, this rate's a 10 and this rate's a 6, so mm-hmm. people could make the choices. I don't know. That would take a lot of work, I think. And
like a third-party verification system?
Yeah, that would be important, a third-party verification system. I think now a lot of consumers rely on their retail grocery stores, those who can afford Whole Foods. You know, go there because they understand their sustainability guidelines and feel like meat is purchased appropriately. And, you know, to a certain degree, Harris Teeter. You even have kind of the larger chains like Safeway. A couple of years ago, started marketing a Rancher's Select of beef that they said it meets these production criteria, and you know they were pretty sound, but again, it's, you know, I think one thing is it can't be, I hate to say this, but you can't make consumers work too hard.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they just don't have the time.
Yeah, and I think that labeling. I mean, I feel like there's not a lot of standardization in the labeling process, at least here in the States. And there are so many different labels that mean so many different things. And the reality is a lot of them aren't really regulated at the federal level. So some of them can just mean whatever, you know, the marketers want them to mean.
Yeah, no, that is an excellent point. Consumers Union does a lot of research like that on labels and how meaningless they are or how meaningless they can be. And I mean, even expiration date labels are open to wide interpretation. So it would take the development of a pretty rigorous system. And like you said, third-party verification would be important.
And it's interesting. I mean, Whole Foods just kind of came under fire in the past few months for their animal welfare rating system sort of not being all that it's, supposed to be, I guess. There, you know, had some issues with that. So even if we do have a standard in place, sometimes it can be hard to follow at various aspects along the supply chain. But
yeah, a lot of times it takes a group like so. There's a really good group that certifies if you meet their production criteria, you'll get a certified animal welfare approved.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep after their producers. They make sure that there's no violations. They audit their producers. So there's none of that kind of slippage like you were just referring to at Whole Foods.
Right.
You have to always be vigilant, I guess.
Yeah. But what about, buying organic? So if we were going to, try and give some advice to consumers, I mean, isn't that a technically a sustainable way that someone can support good purchasing practices?
Yeah, I think for the most part, the organic standards are very, very strong, and there's no slippage there because that is a kind of an official designation. You can't label organic unless you meet those criteria. So I think that's, that's a really important label. There's a new label that is USDA approved for school districts that want to purchase chicken raised without routine antibiotics, and it's called no routine antibiotics label. So, but that doesn't get to the whole sustainability question. So there are things out there. I think organic production is getting pretty big as well. I think they have still a pretty robust brand.
Right. Are there any other mechanisms that you would point to if, for somebody wanting to make a significant impact on the sustainability of the American food system? And if so, like what would this be and what would it take to make it happen?
Well, I think that there's an easy thing consumers can do to kind of reduce their environmental footprint as it relates to meat. And there's a national campaign based in New York called Meatless Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And they, the Center for a Livable Future, is a science advisor to Meatless Monday. And it's basically pretty simple. If you want to cut your saturated fat by 20%, you just cut out meat one day a week. And they say Meatless Monday because it's alliterative and it has ties back into really the First World War, where people were asked to give up meat so troops could eat. As far as sustainability, I mean, there's no one easy thing they can do. It's, I think, just a lot of diligence on the part of consumers to investigate companies and, their meat production practices or, Organic Valley, for example, has a pretty good labeling system for their milk and cheese products. Brands like Applegate Farm have good reputations. So there's no one really easy, quick way on sustainability.
Right. But in general, a consumer can eat less meat, evaluate the brands more rigorously, and support those companies that are making more informed choices.
Yes, that is very well said.
Well, you said it.
Oh, well, Maybe you said it more concisely than I did.
All right. Well, we're going to have to unfortunately wrap up in a few minutes, but I want to know what is on the horizon for the Food System Policy Program. Are there any particular partnerships you're interested in exploring moving forward, or what's on tap?
Well, we're hoping to continue this polling effort. I think what we'd like to do next is try to have a better understanding of people's baseline understanding of the animal production system and try to learn what information they need, whether it's, the environmental impact or the health impacts of meat production and consumption, to change their buying patterns on meat. We do have a new paper out, a white paper that it's called Instituting Change. It's available on the CLF website. And so that's geared to institutional food services or people that want to change their institutional food service to be a more sustainable model, the types of things they need to consider. So, for example, Aramark and Sodexo and Compass are the three major institutional food services, and a lot of hospitals or universities, or in some cases, communities. I've talked some to the health department in New York City about guidelines they want to promulgate on sustainable meat purchases. So we've got a new paper out called Instituting Change that talks about the barriers to securing a more sustainable food service.
There is nothing that Kim and I love talking about more than institutional food purchasing. So I think we're definitely going to have you back to talk about that paper in the near future.
We've got it just came out about 3 weeks ago, and we'd be happy to come back and talk about it. As a matter of fact, I'd be happy to have it was developed under my direction, but I'd be happy to have one of the direct co-authors on the program.
All right. Well, here we go. I'm hosting a show. We're producing future shows in action. You're seeing it all happen right now or listening to it. That is perfect. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Bob, and I really look forward to having you and your colleagues on again.
Thank you for asking me. It's always a pleasure to be on Heritage Radio.
Thank you. Love having you.
Thank you.
All right. Our show is produced by my brilliant co-host Kim Kessler and myself, and our wonderful intern is Austin Brynjarski. Show music is by Tim Archer. I want to thank our sponsors and our show engineer, David Tedeschore. The show is available on Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at EatMattersHRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.